Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is your host, Nick Bilton. So I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you believe, the listener, that America is more divided today than it ever has been before, of course, beyond the Civil War. But that's actually not true. There was a point when the country was more tumultuous, more divided, and even more embroiled in chaos, and that was in 1968. In the first few months of 1968 alone, the country was at war in Vietnam. President Johnson said he would not run for re-election, which of course threw the Democratic Party into complete tumult and chaos. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. There was racial disturbances and protests all across the country. And to top it all off, Robert Kennedy, the brother of JFK, was assassinated right here in Los Angeles while he was running for president. Unlike JFK's assassination, it seemed like this was an open and shut case, the murder of RFK. That one man with one gun killed Robert Kennedy. But my guests today, Mark Smerling and Zach Stewart Pontier, the team behind the Jinx documentary and the podcast Crimetown, are here today to tell us that there could be something more to the murder of RFK. There could have actually been a big government conspiracy to kill Robert Kennedy involving mind control, a woman in a polka dot dress, and a massive police cover-up. Before Mark and Zach join me on the show today, I'm going to do a little inside the hive and invite Abby Tracy onto the show for a quick 15-minute discussion about Brett Kavanaugh, Donald Trump's pick for the Supreme Court. Abby is going to tell us if Kavanaugh is going to try to overturn Roe versus Wade, if all of this swirling chaos around the Democratic Party, if they can actually do anything to stop him from becoming the Supreme Court nominee, and if he does, will he flip the court completely to the right for the next 20, 30 years? So without further ado, let's jump right in. Abby, welcome back to Inside the Hive. Actually, it's Inside the Hive. let's jump right in with the Supreme Court nauseousness. Brett Kavanaugh, can you give us, like, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Should we be terrified? Is Roe versus Wade going to get overturned? Like, what's going on here?
Well, he's certainly a conservative. So, and right now it really looks like he's going to clear the Senate, no real problem. Even some of those senators, you know, Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski, and some Democratic senators, actually, the, you know, Joe Manchin's and people like that, they've really signaled that they aren't going to oppose him and that they're going to let him sort of sail through. So we're kind of at that place where it's almost inevitable that this guy's going to land up on the court. And one of the interesting things is he certainly wasn't of the, you know, top three or four candidates that Trump floated at the very end. He certainly wasn't, you know, the furthest to the right when it came to abortion rights and Roe v. Wade. But many still believe that he will, you know, sort of fall into line with, you know, traditional conservative judges that are on the court. So it's definitely not great. And he's certainly not Merrick Garland or anything like that. But yeah, we're looking at an extreme possibility that he will, you know, fill that ninth seat.
So, okay, so he is a conservative, but there are, you know, I've been reading lots of articles. Some people say he's a really good guy, that there was a story about a guy who play soccer with their kids, play soccer together, and he's a great soccer coach dad and all these different things, and he sounds like a nice guy, sure, but mm-hmm. But you know, what is his philosophy on Roe v. Wade? Like, is he, should people be worried that he will overturn it and it will go down to the states and that some states will make it completely illegal and so on, or is it just kind of TBD at this point? And then also, are there other issues that, you know, we could see massively affected by him on the court? For example, I know the NRA has been staunchly behind him because they believe that he is incredibly pro-Second Amendment. And are there other things that we should know about?
Yeah, definitely. So on your NRA point, absolutely. He's incredibly to the far right in terms of gun rights. And back to kind of like the Roe v. Wade thing, it's kind of tough because he doesn't have too many rulings that sort of deal with this issue. Sort of the most notable one is the recent case involving the undocumented teen who was seeking an abortion, and he actually dissented in that case, so he ruled against her getting the abortion. But sort of the interesting thing about his dissension in that case was it was extremely narrow, and his argument wasn't so much that this individual, you know, shouldn't have access to an abortion, but he sort of raised issue with the timing of it, you know, using that kind of code word like on-demand abortion type of language. So one of the interesting things is, on that ruling, he got, of course, he got attacked, you know, on the left by people that thought, you know, this individual should absolutely have access to an abortion. But then on the right, he was also attacked by conservatives who said he didn't go far enough in his ruling. You know, there were a lot of folks that said, you know, this individual shouldn't even have any sort of access, like, timing be damned. So that's kind of one of those things. And I think that's an overarching pattern that you do actually see in a lot of his rulings, in that, you know, they're kind of these narrow things, like very specific cases. So that case in particular, you know, you're dealing with an undocumented teen who's seeking an abortion. Like, that's a very unique case. And it's sort of hard to extrapolate from that, you know, where he stands more broadly on the law. There have been other times where he's ruled, but he's said, he sort of framed it in Roe v. Wade is the law at that point, just because, you know, he wasn't on the Supreme Court. This was when he was in a lower court. So that is sort of what you go with. And that's the ruling that you stick to. So that's kind of where he falls on that. I think one of the interesting things that I've heard from a bunch of my legal sources who I've spoken with, well, for starters, kind of to your point, everybody's like, great guy, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, very well qualified for the post. Nobody thinks he's like a Judge Jeanine or anything, you know, not a hack or anything like that. But one of the interesting things that they do kind of talk about is that it's sort of hard to take away from his rulings, like how he will rule on the court. That said, one of the most interesting things, and I actually wrote an article this week about this, is getting a lot of play around this 2009 Minnesota Law Review article that he wrote, wherein he made the argument that a president shouldn't be subject to investigations or indictments while they're in office. And that's really obviously, you know, kind of a critical sort of
issue
right
now. But wasn't he he was on the Ken Starr committee that went after Clinton. So isn't that antithetical to that point? And then at the same time, is that part of the reason why Trump maybe picked him?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is, yes, he was absolutely on the Ken Starr investigation, and he was one of the people urging Starr to go harder on Clinton and said, like, we shouldn't cut him any slack on the interview, and really, like, sought to get them to ask really explicit questions about President Clinton and his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, to a kind of creepy degree almost. Ultimately, he said, you know, maybe we shouldn't do this, I believe. But the interesting thing is then he served in the Bush White House, and his takeaway in this 2009 Law Review article was that, hey, like, Ken Starr and all the investigators in that probe, you know, followed the statute that was on the books. But after working in the White House under Bush, I realized that, you know, with everything a president has going on and all the pressures that are on them, you know, asking them to sit through investigations and deal with this huge distraction is just too much. So his argument is they should be able to defer it. So, and he even proposed, like, extending the statute of limitations. So I think, like, the interesting thing is over the past week, a lot of people have kind of freaked out about this. They're like, oh, this guy is only being put on the court to give Donald Trump a free pass, like a get-out-of-jail-free card. If he's on the court, Trump will never see, you know, never really have the screws put to him in terms of the Mueller investigation. But he does say, like, no, the president's not above the law. It's basically, they'll face the law later.
That's actually It seems like that would be a bad play by Trump if the you know, there's so many suits against him right now. If they were, even if the Mueller stuff was pushed off, and let's just say, you know, hypothetically, a Democrat wins in the next election and they go after Trump, that Democrat's not pardoning Trump in the same way that Trump would pardon Trump, right? So
right.
maybe he didn't see that before he decided to nominate him. One of the questions that I keep getting asked, and I'm curious what your answer is to this, is that even let's just say that the Democrats did decide, all right, we're not going to back this guy, we're not going to let him get into the Supreme Court. Could they actually stop it, or is it just there's nothing that they can do?
No, there's nothing that they can really do at all in terms of blocking him without any help from Republicans. You know, they don't have the majority. The filibuster is gone after Gorsuch. So they really have very few tools in their toolbox. So for them, you know, it really came down to Republicans and whether some of those individuals on the fence, whether it was Collins or Murkowski, who, you know, are very into women's rights and reproductive health and have, you know, they ruled against, for instance, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, sort of on those grounds. And so really, there any hope of kind of blocking Kavanaugh hinged on them. And what they can do is they can, sort of clog up the gears of the Senate. And they can make, as one person put it to me, they can make life really annoying for everybody, including themselves, for a long time. But in terms of, like, actually blocking this, they, you know, they can't, which is a real...
But could they make it annoying? Could they make it life so annoying up to November, so that they, if by some chance the Democrats get their seats back, that they could then say no?
No, it wouldn't be that. It'd be more like procedural annoyances and things like that, but nothing that can really effectively delay this. And I think one of the interesting things that actually a Republican Senate aide told me shortly after Kennedy announced his retirement was this idea that nothing unites Republicans and Republican lawmakers more than judges. So this idea that, you know, they're pretty unified in terms of getting this guy through, and you already have them sort of signaling, hey, like the average time it takes to, you know, get a Supreme Court judge confirmed is like 66, 67 days or something. Obviously, they're taking out Merrick Garland, who's an outlier in that statistic there. But so they're really signaling like, no, we're going to get this guy through. We're going to get him through before the midterms. And you guys really, sorry, but this is it.
Speaking of Merrick Garland, the thing that, you know, of course, Mitch McConnell did by refusing to even, you know, meet with him, I think goes down in history as one of Mitch McConnell's most slimy, disgusting things. And he has a long list
pretty
of slimy,
uncool
disgusting things he's done. Are there going to ever be any repercussions for those actions? Or is he just going to be slimy and disgusting until he retires and that's it?
No, there's really nothing. You know, if there was going to be anything, it already would have happened. And I think one of the interesting things actually about that is, so during the Kennedy, you know, right after Kennedy announced his retirement, you really saw Democrats spring into gear, kind of saying, oh, well, you guys should follow the precedent you set with the Garland nomination. And, you know, that it's an election year, it's the midterms coming up, like, we have to wait until the American public speaks on who should be in the Senate. And I think one of the really interesting things that happened was after, as this was all going on, I reached out to Trent Lott, who was the Senate Majority Leader, a Republican Senate Majority Leader before Mitch McConnell, and I think kind of a mentor to McConnell in a way. And I was like, how is this any different? Sort of like, how do you push back on this argument that it's also an election year? And he was incredibly blunt in his response, and he just said, the argument is it's not a presidential election year. So they're really sort of operating on, oh, midterms don't matter. All that matters is whether it's presidential election year or not. So sort of like this idea that the president is the one who picks the nominees and sort of, you know, that power should be left to them and we should wait till the American public sort of responds to that, like leaving out of the equation the fact that the Senate has to confirm Supreme Court justices. So it's like a really kind of interesting way that they're kind of threading this argument of theirs.
I love the Republicans' ability to rewrite the rules in the middle of the game always, and for the Democrats to be so pathetic that they don't do anything to stop it from happening.
Yeah.
It's, you know, gerrymandering, Supreme Court. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Okay, so last couple of questions before we get to my next interview about RFK. What is, you know, we're seeing this kind of tide, not switch, but come in the Democratic Party because people are so fed up with the Democratic leadership. And we saw it with Cortez winning in New York a couple of weeks ago. And one thing that's really fascinating from the perspective of looking at this from kind of like a 10,000 foot view is that before Cortez won, and for people that haven't been following, she is, you know, she beat a, how many terms had the guy been, the congressman been in? I mean, it was like five terms or something like that.
Yeah, he'd been there like 20 years.
20 years, came out of nowhere. She's incredible. You should check her out. But one of the things that was so fascinating to watch from the side is that pre-Cortez winning, everyone was, you know, let's back Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and the people we've backed for decades and years. And then afterwards, it seems like there was kind of this tide shift of like, we've got to get rid of Pelosi and people like that because they haven't changed a damn thing and they're not going to, and we need new blood, and people like Cortez are going to be those people. Do you think that there is a chance that we could see a positive destruction in the Democratic Party that is so well needed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things that you've seen in sort of this new crop of candidates is that the majority of them, or many of them at least, have pledged that if they are elected, that they won't back Pelosi and sort of the current leadership structure that's in place. And I think there's definitely something to be powerful there. I think when we look at the, you know, the AOC election victory, a lot of people, you know, they're like, oh, look how far left the party's moving. They're like, you know, she's a Democratic socialist. They're like, you know, that won't work everywhere. That's not how you're going to win 2020. But I think one of the interesting things is it's, you have to sort of view this, take a step back and view it in terms of, you know, we've also seen Conor Lamb get elected and individuals like that who are, you know, much more moderate or more toward the center. And I think the actual sort of line connecting these people is that they're young and that they're new blood and that they're new faces. And I think, you know, there is sort of a lot of frustration within the Democratic Party with the kind of, you know, sort of static nature of it. You know, they want to see things shaken up. They want to see these new faces. They want new blood. And it's, and I think that is kind of the trend to pay attention to, not, you know, that she was a Democratic socialist or something like that. I think it's more about, you know, new people who you think are actually going to change the game in Washington.
All right. So last question, back to the Supreme Court, and then we'll let you get back to your writing. the Chief Justice, John Roberts, when he was assigned to the court, we all assumed, I remember assuming that he was going to be incredibly conservative, even maybe as much as Thomas. And he has, in some instances, been not conservative and has voted kind of down the middle. He's still with a conservative bent and so on. Mm-hmm. And it seems that, you know, I mean, you see this, and if you get into a discussion with anyone about a topic, and you know, you kind of, your side can change, even with justices and judges, your side can change based on the arguments that other people make, and this, of course, we all know happens on the Supreme Court too, and there's, you know, there's some horse playing going on where there's trades and things like that. Do you think that when we get another conservative justice on the court, one that is going to be more conservative in a lot of these liberal issues like abortion and gun rights and so on than Kennedy was, do you think that there's a world where some of these conservative judges kind of come more to the center, and maybe even Chief Justice Roberts becomes a little bit more liberal, especially in a Roe v. Wade or something like that?
Yeah, I actually had an interesting conversation on this exact topic with a constitutional law professor who was actually at like the Gorsuch confirmation hearing, and he
was that Chief Justice Roberts calling?
Yeah,
you
that was then, he was or? He heard his name. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. But no, I actually had a conversation with somebody about this recently, and sort of, you know, what could happen with the departure of Kennedy, because obviously, as everybody likely is aware of, is Kennedy ended up being, you know, kind of a critical swing vote, especially on social issues like gay rights and abortion and a lot of it having to do with sort of individual privacy and things of that nature. But I was talking to somebody, and they made the point that John Roberts doesn't love to see, you know, sweeping social changes being made with rulings. So sort of this idea that they presented to me was, you know, he would be unlikely to allow a full frontal attack on Roe v. Wade. So he would never probably want to see it fully overturned, but could kind of see it being, you know, attacked at the margins a little bit. So whether that's, you know, changing when it's legal to have your abortion. So, you know, changing, saying like, oh, after 20 weeks or something like that, that it's illegal. But so kind of this idea that, you know, he will likely serve a bit as a bulwark against, you know, major changes such as overturning Roe v. Wade or things of that nature. And I do think it is important to some of these folks as to what public opinion is. And despite kind of the idea that it's two parties, like if you're a Republican, like you're absolutely opposed to abortion. And if you're a Democrat, you're totally for women's right to choose. And I think one of the interesting things is, like, within both parties, you know, there's a little bit, you know, there are Democrats that oppose abortion and there are Republicans that are pro-choice. And I think when you have a justice like John Roberts, who kind of sees himself as kind of a guard against these major, major changes, you likely will see that presented in his rulings to come. I think especially, you know, considering that the weight of the court is likely going to change with the addition of Kavanaugh if he's officially confirmed.
All right. Well, on that note, all I do every night now as I go to bed is I look up in the skies and I pray to Ruth Ginsburg that she makes it through the night.
Yeah. Keep working out, Ruth, right?
For the next 40 years until Trump is no longer president.
RBG.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
RBG.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you so much for chatting today. Stay tuned. Up next, we have a fascinating interview with the guys behind the RFK tapes.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
So last year, I bought my wife some perfume and was later horrified to find out the things that they put in the stuff. They have synthetic colors, parabens to prevent bacteria, all these different kinds of plastics and chemicals. It's really nasty stuff that you're putting on your skin. But there's now a new fragrance company that does absolutely none of that. It's a company that's bringing the feeling back into fragrances, and it's called Fleur. So Fleur is accessible to anyone. It's like having a friend who knows a lot about fragrances, and it's not only good for you and your skin, but also for the earth. There's no questionable ingredients. It's eco-conscious packaging. It's really, really cool because you can actually tell which fragrance is right for you directly from their website. No, they did not invent Smell-O-Vision. You will have to go to the website to see what I'm talking about, but trust me, it's very cool. Their scents are all gender-free, and the best part is Fleur is completely transparent as a fragrance company. They tell you every ingredient in their perfumes and why it's there. There's no secrets, no nasty ingredients, and no bullshit. And Fleur scents are really cool, incorporating ingredients like fig, white flowers, hazelnut, sandalwood. You really have to check out the site to see what I'm talking about. So go to Fleur.com, that's Phlur.com today, and use the promo code HIVE, which of course is HIVE, and you can get 20% off your custom Fleur sample set. Pick 3 scents to try and just check it out. It's amazing. Once again, the promo code is HIVE, HIVE, and the website is Fleur.com to try 3 fragrances of your choice at 20% off, Phlur.com.
My name's Sergeant Jordan. This is Rampart Detectives. What is your name, sir? No comment?
Thanks so much for joining me today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Mark, by the way, the older guy.
And I'm Zach.
The younger guy. I'm probably somewhere in the middle guy. I'm Nick. So let's jump right in. I have a lot of questions, but for the people listening who don't know anything about anything, can one of you guys give us just a brief synopsis of who RFK was and how you ended up doing this incredible documentary podcasty thing that I can't stop listening to?
Sure. Well, thanks for the compliment. Robert Kennedy was a senator from New York, and in 1968, he was running for president. He's JFK's younger brother, and he also was attorney general for John F. Kennedy and very involved in those campaigns. And he was assassinated on June 5th, 1968, in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel. Sirhan Sirhan was caught at the scene with a gun, and basically the case has been perceived for many years as open and shut. This guy did it. Not a lot of mystery. And I think what struck me about the case from the very beginning is that the police recorded just about everything. And so there was this just incredible amount of material, cassette tapes and different things that came out of the California State Archives and other places. And it really, really allows you to be a fly on the wall from the first moment of the investigation, when Sirhan Sirhan is in the police interrogation room and won't even reveal his name, all the way through like many of the various times this case has been brought back up, it gets a lot of coverage. So there was just an incredible amount of material.
And the cops, they recorded everything because there was still such a mystery around JFK's shooting. Is that partially why?
I think that was a part of it. I also think that it was standard at that time to make recordings of these interviews. They certainly knew it was a big case, and they certainly knew about the questions.
No, I think it's more pointed than that, right? I mean, they were trying to subvert any chance of a conspiracy, I think, because there was so much conspiracy swirling around the JFK assassination, because things happened very quickly and nothing was recorded. And, you know, they decided on this one pretty early on that they were going to clean up the witness testimony in a way that, you know, by recording it, by making sure that they were being transparent. It didn't end up that they were transparent, but they started out in a good place.
The thing I find so fascinating about this era, 1968 specifically, that year, is just there's 82 days where it just seems like the world shakes. You've got President Johnson, who declines to run for a second term. You have Martin Luther King Jr., who's been assassinated. You have Robert Kennedy, who's been assassinated. There's racial disturbance. It's essentially kind of the most chaotic period of time since the Civil War. Do you think, when you kind of, with all the research that you've done, that this was a period, and RFK's assassination was kind of a period that changed everything?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, there's been a couple times in our history, the Vietnam War, you know, Kent State, war protests, civil rights movement, where the country became so divided that, you know, things got kind of crazy. And people today are talking about a divided country. I think that's what attracted me to the subject matter as well, is we live in a very divided time now, and you see conspiracies sort of popping up left and right. And certainly from a bird's eye perspective, conspiracies sort of feed on division and feed on people's suspicions that the other side is doing nefarious things. And they are born out of conflict and a divided nation. So, yeah, I think that time is unique in American history. And people today, you know, they're like, well, we live in a divided time. But back then, people were getting killed. I mean, one thing that Zach left out was that RFK was running for president. He just won the California Democratic nomination. So, you know, he was killed on the cusp of a career that could have changed everything. He was definitely a guy who had gone from being working alongside Eugene McCarthy during the Red Scare to some sort of epiphany during his brother's assassination, to working side by side with civil rights advocates and really advocating for the poor and immigrants.
It's amazing when you listen to him speak about those times, how relevant it feels to today.
Well, that's the thing that for me was so fascinating. I kind of went down the internet rabbit hole and was watching speeches and listening to audio and reading transcripts and things. And you could literally take those speeches and put them to today and they would be just 100% apt. That you wouldn't have to change a word. And it's so fascinating to see the relationship between 68 and today. Do you think that when you kind of look at the story of RFK and where we are today, do you think that there are massive parallels, or is it just two different points in time?
I think you can certainly draw parallels. I mean, I think it's pretty interesting to me that Robert Kennedy was speaking for what he calls a forgotten working class at that time. Mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting to hear that sort of reverberation nowadays with President Trump speaking for those people. But at the same time, like, he also is really, when he speaks about immigrants, he's incredibly thoughtful and powerful and supportive, and you don't feel that from President Trump. So I find there isn't like a straight line, I think.
Well, I'm impressed that you can say the words President Trump without gagging. It's pretty impressive. I still have a really hard time putting those two words together.
You can't see my face right now, but
yeah. I would add one thing to that. I would say that, you know, in 1968, a lot of Americans of different colors and, you know, a lot of Americans from different classes were trying to figure out where they were in society. And just like today, I feel like the birth of Trump, the birth of this conservative movement, is a lot about the same issues, that there are certain people in our society who are feeling displaced, who feel entitled to certain, you know, certain respect in our society or positions in our society.
But isn't it the difference, though, is that in 68, the people who would have voted for Hillary today or in 2016 were the ones who were felt displaced, versus today it's the opposite side?
Yeah, that's
is
true.
That right?
Yeah,
that's what
But
I was
remember,
trying.
Nixon wasn't far after. You know, I mean, there was a conservative backlash just like we're feeling now.
Well, so I have a million questions about the assassination and Sirhan Sirhan and all the conspiracy theories, but I just want to jump a little bit more into Robert Kennedy before we get to those. So from my perspective, and I haven't done a ton of research, I've just, you know, listened to the podcast and so on, he seemed like an incredible person.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. I think what makes him incredible is he had this incredible ability to change his mind about big issues. He was one of the few politicians who was willing to say, I was wrong about that. And I think at that time in our history, we were looking for some level of honesty and transparency. And he seemed extremely honest and transparent.
Yeah, I mean, it was when he talks about wanting to end the war in Vietnam, as an example. I mean, he was incredibly invested and was literally in the room when they were planning different aspects of that war. So you could imagine politicians nowadays are so afraid to say, oh, I might have been wrong about that, or I changed my mind, or I, you know, and he wasn't.
Okay, so let's go to the night that he is shot. It's Los Angeles. Can you walk us through that moment and then how we, of course, get to the point where we find out that there may be some sort of conspiracy behind who actually shot RFK?
Sure. So Robert Kennedy had announced the winner. It was election day in the California primary, and he had been he'd sort of been laying low. Most of the work on the campaign had been over, you know, obviously, and it was the volunteers were getting people out to vote and all that. And he was hanging out with his family all day, and then went to the Ambassador Hotel to deliver his victory speech shortly after midnight. And you know, you hear him give his speech, and as he's leaving to go to another press conference, they take him through the hotel kitchen pantry. And Sirhan Sirhan steps out with a gun, and you know, his entourage included George Plimpton, Rayford Johnson, Rosie Grier, and these are the people who sort of spring into action and wrestle the gun away from Sirhan Sirhan.
So what immediately they get the gun from Sirhan Sirhan, and then they think, okay, this is an open and shut case. But when I start reading more about it, it turns out that there were 13 bullet holes, is that correct? And there was only 8 slots in Sirhan's gun. There were things that came up in the autopsy report, as you guys detail in the podcast, where the autopsy says that the bullet had hit him from just a, you know, point blank range, just mere inches away, whereas Sirhan was a few feet away. Don't the cops question that at all, or is it just like, okay, well, we found the guy with the gun, that's who did it?
So just to take those kind of questions one at a time, there's certainly there's some problems with the case on a closer look, and there's certainly some questions that come up. The first of which is a problem between the eyewitness testimony and the autopsy. The bullets, the autopsy says the bullets were fired at point blank range from 1 to 3 inches away from Kennedy, from behind Kennedy, and everybody says that Sirhan was 3 to 6 feet away from Kennedy and standing in front of him. And then there's a bullet count question, which is that Sirhan's gun holds 8 bullets. There's 4 bullets that go into Kennedy. 3 of them hit him and 1 goes through his jacket. And there are 5 victims that their bullet holes pulled out of their bodies. So right there, that's already,
and then there's also some bullet holes in the door frame too.
And then there's some questions. There's some photographs of bullets, of potential bullet holes in the door frame. The conspiracy people would say that that is proof of that a second gun is firing.
And the non-conspiracy people would say, oh well, maybe the bullet passed through someone and hit the door frame,
or maybe they're not bullets. Maybe those are mislabeled, or you know, it's very hard in a chaotic scene to really understand like how bullets travel.
Yeah, and this sort of story, because of the desire by the police in their investigation to make things as clear as possible, certain things become unclear. You know, witness testimony becomes unclear whether it's reliable, and you know, things like actual forensic evidence, ballistics evidence become unclear because they ended up throwing those door jams away and they're lost to time. So nobody really gets a good look at them.
Yeah, they're booked into evidence. The door frames are booked into evidence that night. And about shortly after Sirhan's trial, while he's appealing, a bunch of evidence is destroyed.
Why was the evidence destroyed? Was it accidental, or
the cops said that there wasn't a lot of room in the evidence locker,
and it wasn't part of the original trial, so it never came up in trial. So the police said it wasn't evidence in the trial, so it wasn't evidence of the crime. You know, but ultimately, you know, I think there's probably a desire to just keep things simple.
So when you look at this case in you the way you two both approached it, did you think when you first heard about this, did you think, oh, this is just one of those silly conspiracy theories, you know, like an Alex Jones type thing? Or were you immediately like, hey, something's not right here? And by the end of it, what was your conclusion to those questions too?
Well, I had a very personal relationship with this case in a weird roundabout way. I'd heard an early documentary that my co-host Bill Klaber had made in the 90s. And so I knew about this for a long time, but I hadn't really dug in on it. I think you'll have to wait to see how the conclusion that we come to.
I mean, it's just from doing crime and thinking about conspiracies. This is really our first dive into conspiracies. They're not that far apart. You know, when you look at complicated crimes, you often find out that the police try to fix the evidence to the benefit of their case, and the defense does the same. And, you know, once the initial witness testimony is taken and initial observations are done, everything becomes edited in a way. And so there's a question of whether are these bullet holes valid? Are they real bullet holes? If they are, was there another gun, or were they nail holes or something else? It's impossible to tell because the police cleaned up the evidence. in a way that promoted their view of the case.
So you guys have done a number of crime-related documentaries and podcasts now, and is your feeling that, you know, when you look at witness testimony, that it is blurred, it is inaccurate, it is sometimes colored by the police or colored by someone's views, or is this just kind of an outlier?
Well, I think that witness testimony has proven over and over again, just in the last, you know, more so in the last 5-6 years than ever before, to be consistently inaccurate in certain cases that are politicized or the stakes are very high. Because what happens is, you know, I always try to go back to the initial statement because that's the purest witness statement. But over time, people start to, I mean, this has been done in psychological studies, people start to change their stories to benefit other people. They start to want to please other people. And, you know, so these stories, they change over time. So by the time you get to trial, which usually in a criminal case can be 2 years, in a big one, can be 2 years, 3 years after the initial indictments, everybody's been cleaning up the paths of the witnesses and cleaning up the paths of the evidence, and you have to be very objective to every piece of evidence, and you have to demand to go back to the source and see how things have changed. You just can't take everything at face value.
Okay, so let's get to Sirhan Sirhan. He is the alleged shooter, and as you start the show, you talk about, you know, you play the recording of him refusing to talk. And then, of course, we get to the point where you bring up the fact that he may have been hypnotized or mind controlled. Tell us that story of that progression.
So Sirhan Sirhan is captured at the scene with a gun, and he's taken to the LAPD Rampart Division, and he's questioned, and he doesn't say a lot. And actually, the first thing that starts to emerge is a political motive. Before any talk of hypno-programming. He claims not to remember the crime. He claims not to understand why he committed the crime. And gradually, over the course of, and we did a whole episode with these therapy sessions between the court, the psychiatrists for the prosecution and the defense spent days with Sirhan trying to get him to remember and trying to understand why he had done this. And what starts to emerge is he's kind of grasping for an explanation. And
Sirhan's grasping for an explanation.
Everybody is, but yes, even Sirhan is. And I think he makes a decision to he is terrified that people are going to think he's mentally ill. And he comes to this conclusion that was certainly, you see the seeds of that was a political assassin, and this was politically motivated because of some claims that because of some of the statements that Senator Kennedy made about sending jets to Israel. And Sirhan Sirhan was born in Jerusalem.
So he's Palestinian.
He's Palestinian.
Palestinian, yeah. So, but he, when you get to the point where you start to unveil that there's this kind of mind manipulation thing going on, there are points where I can see both sides of it, where you're like, okay, well, this makes total sense. You know, the CIA was doing all sorts of crazy shit back then. You know, they were giving drugs to, I mean, there's so many stories, right? You know, in the Vietnam War, where they're giving like LSD to soldiers to see if they fight better. There's like doing these time machine things, but you don't know what's real and what's not. And do you kind of get the sense as you're researching this, that this could be real?
We're doing a whole episode on mind control, and you're going to hear from some people that examined Sirhan, and you're going to hear their take on that. It's certainly far-fetched.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you have to continue to do in these things, and why the podcast platform is so great for this, and I think this is why we've been doing more podcasts and television lately, is you got to slow the story down to a crawl. And allow the audience to experience it in the chronology of what happened rather than retrospectively looking back with all context involved and everybody's opinion involved. So if you listen to the Sirhan episode where they're hypnotizing him, you see the evolution of thought from a guy who's denying he's denying he has any memory of this thing, to a political assassin who's doing it for the, you know, the people who've been persecuted by Israel, the Palestinians in particular. Now, is that change in Sirhan the function of doctors poking around in his brain using hypnotism, and his sort of historical experiences? You know, he was watched his brother die in Jerusalem. He was there during the Six-Day War. It was very violent, and he was just a child. Or is it something else? Is it that was something that was identified by people who could manipulate him and hypnotize him to kill Kennedy? You know, it could have been that, but it seems like you have to make a decision for yourself by sort of bathing in the material.
One of the things I found really fascinating was the senator who, the former congressman, Lowenthal, is that right?
Lowenstein,
who knew Kennedy, who was actually waiting for him to call him the moment he was shot, who was not in any way a conspiracy theorist, who was a traditional congressman, and then became, you know, I guess he self-describes himself as one, and how quickly, you know, you can go down this rabbit hole of trying to figure out what's real and what's not. I've worked for the New York Times for many years. I worked for Vanity Fair for many years. I've written several books, and I always find I find it hard to believe a lot of the times when I see just how dysfunctional the government is, that there could be these grand conspiracy theories.
That is the biggest argument against them, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book American Kingpin on the Silk Road drug empire, and I mean the cops and the FBI agents, they're all really nice guys, but they all hated each other. There was people, no one wanted to talk to each other. It's kind of almost impossible that there could be some larger, not kind of, it is impossible that there could have been some larger conspiracy theory, conspiracy going on with that case. Do you think, like, when you look at the RFK tapes, when you look at the JFK assassination, Martin Luther King, all these different things, do you think that back then maybe there was, and this is the thing that Lowenstein started to believe?
Well, the thing that really started Lowenstein on his journey was Nixon's enemies list. And mm-hmm. he was number seven or something, and he wasn't even a former congressman anymore. And that was, you know, that was a real thing that was going on.
Tell us what, for the people out there that don't remember the Nixon enemies list, tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. It came out, you know, during the Watergate, I don't know exactly when it came out, during the hearings maybe, but that there had been a list of people that Nixon wanted to get. And he, you know, was dubbed the enemies list. And he was using all the sort of things in his power to make these people's lives miserable with tax audits and different things like that. And Lowenstein was on this list. And I think it sort of threw him for a loop that, you know, that Nixon even was that concerned with what this former congressman, who was basically on a speaking tour going around the country speaking to law students, that he felt attacked in that way. And it called into question what the government was up to,
or at least
capable. And he was someone
of. Right.
Yeah, and he was someone who had worked for it,
and he had someone that, and right, it really as he says, it really his cosmology was shook.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you, Nick, that when you look at these things on the ground and you go through them, you start to see how simple in some ways and how complicated the personalities are who are involved, and you start to sense motivations that may not spell conspiracy. And as you lift higher in the air and you look at it going back contextually, the things you need to believe happen in a grand conspiracy like this become harder and harder to understand when you understand human nature and you understand the institutions that are sort of behind these things. You know, like you know, we've sort of been involved with law enforcement and DA's offices and stuff like that. And just like everywhere else in the world, there are great people who do their job incredibly well, and they're very buttoned up. And there are people who sort of are doing it because it's their job, and you're not necessarily as buttoned up. So to believe that all these people could be aligned in some sort of magical way to create a conspiracy that's so mind-blowing that one leak of it could bring down an entire government is hard to fathom.
But at the same time, you know, on the flip side, this is where your brain starts to kind of melt a little bit. On the flip side of it, there are clearly conspiracies that the government has been involved in. You know, there's all the things that have come out about the CIA where they, you know, were using magicians during the war to fake things, assassination attempts, you know, all these things that they have done that were conspiracies, for want of a better word. And there's also things, you know, I mean, JFK, like, I personally do not believe that it was Lee Harvey Oswald that killed him alone. It just is mind-boggling that would ever be believed, but, you know, maybe I'm completely wrong.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
I have a question for you, dear listeners. Are you struggling to get some sleep at night? I know I am. I lay awake most nights thinking about all the crazy news. It also doesn't help if you don't have a very comfortable mattress. But there is help around the corner. The fine people at Mattress Firm are here for you when you are looking for ways to improve your sleep. These are mattress experts here, people. They can also help you build your bed, from headboards to adjustable bases to sheets. They even have bedroom decor. They've got you covered literally and figuratively. Plus, if you go to mattressfirm.com/podcast, you can save 10% with the code podcast10. Once again, that's mattressfirm.com/podcast, where you can save 10% on a new mattress or anything with the code podcast10. Mattress Firm offers a 120-night sleep trial, so you can rest assured that you'll love your mattress or your money back. And they offer a 120-night low-price guarantee, so you know you paid the perfect price if you see something cheaper along the way. Once again, if you go to mattressfirm.com/podcast, you can save 10% with the code podcast10. And there are more than 3,000 stores nationwide, so Mattress Firm is right around the corner if you are looking for a really perfect good night's sleep. With all the stuff that you guys have, all the stories that you've done, all these incredible documentaries and narratives and so on, when you look back at them, has your viewpoint on all of these topics and investigations and conspiracies and things like that, have they changed over time, or have they been affirmed in one direction or another?
I don't know that we approach it that way. I mean, obviously, I guess on some level you're always searching for the truth, but I think, to be honest with you, we're also trying to tell a good story and an entertaining story, and you know, we're so I guess looking back on things, I also don't look back on things very often. I don't know. I haven't seen I couldn't even tell you what's in the jinx at the end of the day and what got cut at the last second. I mean, so it's a difficult question. I don't look back and I go, oh, I have a different perspective on the whole thing now.
Yeah. I try not to also get too intellectual about these things, because ultimately, you know, if you over-intellectualize these events, it's hard to see them clearly, you know? So I think for us, the fun is actually telling the story in a beat-by-beat through a chronology sort of way and revealing to the audience truths, not necessarily a whole truth, but a series of truths that people probably aren't looking at because they're so blinded by the intellectuality of the analysis of it and the fog of, you know, context and commentary. So stripping all that away and just going into these tapes and telling the story through the tapes and letting the audience decide kind of where they fall is the fun of it for us. So getting too much left or right or up and down and too much involved in theories.
And telling people what to think.
I think it ruins it.
Yeah. No, I'm more curious if your thought process has changed.
You mean, have we
years.
Built bunkers in our backyard? Is that what you
have
want?
Have you built bunkers, and do you wear silver foil hats when you're visiting CIA offices?
Well, you have to, because if you don't wear the hat, If you don't wear the hat, they can read your mind. So, of course, we wear the hats.
How do you think I knew how you'd answer these questions today? So let's get back to the actual story, and then I have a lot of questions for you about the reporting process and the tapes and things like that. But one of the things that I find really fascinating about this specific story is it doesn't seem to have gotten the same amount of attention that JFK got. Is that because for many years people just, I mean, part of it, of course, is JFK was the president, but still, this was a, if this happened today, of an assassination of a, you know, someone running for president, would it take place, it would shake the world, and it would be all we'd be talking about for a very long period of time, whether or not we knew who did it or who didn't do it, or if there was a conspiracy. Of course, there would be a conspiracy because of the world we live in today with social media, but it seems like this did not get a lot of attention. Is that just because I wasn't alive then or around then or old enough to read the newspaper, or is it because it was kind of believed to be an open and shut case for such a long time, and then people started to kind of look at it?
I think it's a couple of things. I think it's also in something that you mentioned earlier, and that this was one of a string of events in a really difficult time for the country. And so there's all these things happening that sort of tell a larger story. I mean, you know, the Chicago convention, that Democratic convention a few months after this was also incredibly violent and divided. And, you know, so, and obviously we were talking about Martin Luther King's death. And so I think Bobby Kennedy's assassination becomes kind of a part of that story. A little bit more, it gets grouped together into, you know, Nixon's election and then Watergate, and then it's like there's all these other events around it that are also very important. And yeah, there isn't a lot of slowed down storytelling, as Mark was saying, like going beat by beat through this time and this case.
Yeah, there's something else that happened, right? They did record everything, but they locked it away. You know, there was a definite attempt to keep these tapes under wraps for a long period of time. And I think that there's, you know, just like everything else, people sort of, their interests wane, they're not looking at it. There's a couple people like Bill Klaber who you know, who went back, and every time a tape was released, he would listen to it and he would analyze it. And, you know, for the most of us, it just passed. It just went by. And Sirhan was caught with a gun 5 feet from Kennedy. So, you know, it felt open and shut. But when those tapes started to come out and people started listening to the witness testimony and all the other stuff, they started looking into it.
So tell us about those tapes. So they were recorded. How many hours were there?
Oh, I mean, there's hundreds of tapes.
Yeah.
So we haven't even calculated that, because it would be so, I would have a panic attack right here if I knew how much footage there was. But there's a lot. There's a lot.
Don't worry. No one can see your panic attack. Right here. The beauty of podcasts. And why did they lock them away? And how did you get access to the stuff that has not been heard before?
Why they locked it away is a question I don't totally know. I think it must have had to do with a lot of what was happening, which was like, we need to simplify this. We need to make sure that this doesn't become a conspiracy. And so maybe the best way to do that is to lock these tapes away. And for 20 years, a lot of people fought really hard to get them released. And eventually in 1988, 20 years later, they were all moved to the California State Archives and opened to the public. How we got Bill.
Yep.
Bill had a lot of the tapes, but we spent a lot of time corresponding with Beth, the librarian at the California State Archives, who's amazing, who copies a lot of these tapes for us.
Yeah. I mean, the job in all these things is to actually listen to them. And that's a huge job, and there's very few people who have the time and, you know, patience to listen to them, you know. And plus, Bill Klaber, this has been his sort of opus, right? So he's been interviewing people all along the way since you know, soon after the assassination. So he has tapes of his own with people that have now passed away, but he dug into these events with them.
What is your process? Do you divide and conquer? Do you get transcripts made of the tapes? and then, you know, figure out how to cut it all up and make it into this narrative. How do you guys approach these things? Because this is, you know, of course, you've been doing this for quite a while now in Crime Town, and it was very similar in its style of taking these interviews and public, you know, commentary and kind of piecing it together in this beautiful narrative. How do you guys approach it?
I think the first thing we do is we look at the story holistically. We try to see the landmarks in the story. And everything's built sort of from the very beginning on a chronology. We don't break chronology until we get into the creative aspects of how to tell the story better for the audience. What we try to do is understand the landmarks and how we move from one landmark to the next. So if it's a crime story, there's a crime, there's a trial, there may be appeals. You know, with Bob Durst, there were multiple landmarks in that story. There were three murders. With this, there are landmarks in the story. There's, you know, there's the girl with the polka dot dress. There's the guns. There's this, there's that. There was a trial. So that's the first step. And thank God for podcasting, because there's a lot of young people who are willing to sit down and listen to these tapes. And I don't personally listen to the tapes. I know Zach listens to a lot of the tapes. And you know, they listen to it, and we talk about it, and they pull things from the tapes that relate to these landmarks. And we start to sort of find a path from one spot to the next, to the next. And then we start thinking about how the story can be presented to an audience.
You've both done television before. What's different in the storytelling when you're doing it visually versus doing it on a podcast?
There's a few things. I think on the one hand, like, it was really exciting when we got into podcasts, because it felt so much easier than lugging lights and a camera around to just be Mark and I go up to Providence and record on our little, you know, Zoom recorder. And so that's an exciting difference. When we're putting these things together, when you have visuals, you can do a lot more things. You can move through time quicker. You can have more characters. I think we were very struck. Our early Crime Town assemblies were challenged and not as simple. And I think with a podcast and with audio storytelling, you have to draw a simpler line through it, because people don't have the visuals to rely on. You know, if you see a movie and somebody's walking down the street and you look down at your phone for a second and then you look up and the guy's in a bar, you go, oh, okay, so he must have gotten into the bar. I'm not lost. But if that happens with a podcast, like, the train, you have no idea where you are, and it's very frustrating. You might as well turn it off.
Yeah. There's another thing about television and movies. It's, and particularly in documentary, and starting with Errol Morris, there's this visual storytelling that's going on. You know, regardless of whether you're doing a recreation, you know, of the crime, or you're of a moment in the trial or whatever, you're sending messages to the audience visually. So there's another track to sort of evolve as a piece of storytelling, and you don't have that with podcasts. So ultimately, you know, the podcast is got something else. It's much more intimate, and you feel very, very close to it. You know, it's in your ear, and that has a different type of value. It's a very different thing for me, because I shoot stuff, you know. So for me, I'm always, when we're making television or something, I'm trying to think of how are we going to tell this story visually, you know, because we can help the storytelling with visuals. In this, the intimacy is the power in some ways.
One of the things I find really fascinating lately is that we, you know, I watched the documentary Wild Wild Country and couldn't stop watching. I listened to Crime Town. I, you know, Serial. There are, you know, narrative nonfiction crime books, but in a lot of these instances, you know, Wild Wild Country, for example, the footage was sitting around. It was 300 hours of footage that had been there for a long time. With the RFK tapes, same thing. Why do you think we're? Do you think we're in this period now where people want this real stuff because they're kind of sick of all the fake social media stuff? Or is it just that we now have the technologies to be able to kind of pull these things together better and tell different stories? Or what is it that you think has given rise to such an interest in these true crime narratives, especially the stuff that you guys spend so much time on?
Yeah, well, certainly technology had a big part of it, right? I mean, we you know, Andrew and I made Capturing the Freedmans, which is largely home movies. And we recognized in that the power of the home movie. And that is a piece of technology. They were shooting with Super 8. And then later, you know, David got a VHS camera. And all of a sudden, there's this whole thing available that we didn't know before. Like the taping of these interviews is a little older technology. But, you know, they didn't tape interviews, you know, in the 40s and 50s, you know. So now you have people taping interviews. Wild Country, obviously, there's somebody running around with a VHS camera. And these materials are out there. So I think it was only a matter of time before storytellers recognized the value of those materials and started using them to tell stories.
And do you think that, you know, when you look forward at the next few things you're going to do, what are some examples of new kinds of narratives and stories that you guys are looking at? Or are you just focused on the RFK tapes right now and haven't picked your next project?
We have another season of Crime Town coming in the fall, so we're working hard on that, and that'll run through next year. And yeah. Then Mark's working on a TV show.
Yeah, I'm working on a TV show. Another TV show.
What's the TV show?
You know, I probably shouldn't overshare on that right now. Sorry, okay. Nick. I want to, but it's very early. And
don't worry, no one's listening.
Yeah. And you know, it's just like I'm trying to just figure it out myself for right now. So
yep. Yeah. Totally understand that world. If you could pick a dream crime story to do, let's just say, like, pretend that the footage is hidden away somewhere and we never knew it was there, and you kind of found it in a vault that you accidentally opened, what would be the dream story for either of you guys?
Wow. That's a good question.
Can we get those Watergate tapes from the very beginning to the end? I think they're probably available now. We just need those 18 minutes.
It's so hard to imagine what kind of tapes might be out there in the world. You know?
Yeah, I mean, Wild Wild Country is a really good example of when I was watching it, I thought to myself, are those recreations? They're so well done.
But oh, yeah, quality, I had a few moments like that.
Yeah, I mean, the quality of the tape, the quality of the, I don't know if the story, it's intimacy, right? I mean, those tapes give you an inside look into something that I've never seen before. And then you get to meet those people now and they get to talk about it. It's kind of fantastic.
And also visually, with the maroon colors, it was such a visual thing.
It was art directed.
Christ. And when they cut to with the guns, you're just, I mean, I hit the floor. I can't believe it.
Yeah. That scene with the guns was like, what the...
Yeah. So
great.
I don't know if it's about, you know, which of these stories in the world would be great. It's like, what footage is out there? And you can't predict. I mean, there's no predicting it, right? What footage is out there that could create a great story, you know? And then the intimacy of that footage and how emotional it is.
And unfortunately, when you start the stories, you never really know what you're going to find. I mean, we've had so many experiences of trying to tell a story. Crime Town, for example, when we found the grand jury testimony of Buddy after he had been caught kidnapping a man in his living room, and we discovered, you know, 13 hours of grand jury testimony. I mean, we never knew we were going to find that. But when we found it, it was like, oh, this has got to be an episode.
Yeah. I will say one thing. We, after The Jinx, we made a conscientious effort to avoid another murder story. Not that I have anything against murder stories, but there was just a rash of murder stories. And I remember getting multiple calls about showrunning JonBenet Ramsey television shows. I think there were four of them at the end of the day. And I thought to myself, you know, this whole thing that we are working on, which is our wheelhouse, is applicable to things that are much broader than just whether somebody killed somebody or not. And I thought, let's go do Crime Town, you know, because ultimately crimes are as interesting no matter how broad they become, if it's corruption or if it's conspiracies. That's more interesting to me right now than simple murder stories. Not to say that if the tape came in and it was a really interesting story, we wouldn't get excited about it.
What was in the process of doing the RFK tapes, what was your kind of holy shit moment, the thing you listened to, the thing you discovered where you were like, oh my God, that's insane?
Rosicrucians. For me, that was Rosicrucians.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, like a lot of people who are isolated, Sirhan Sirhan had become very isolated. He'd come over from the Middle East, and he didn't fit in. And a lot, like Oswald, he had sort of turned against what everybody else was doing in a very, very clear way. Oswald turned to communism, but Sirhan, he turned to the Rosicrucians, which is a cult-like, I don't know, I'm going to get in trouble, but is a group of people who practice a lot of cult-like things, like self-hypnosis. So when we were going through the tapes and he starts talking about Rosicrucians, there's another alternative to some sort of huge conspiracy and hypno-programming, which is he hypnotized himself. And that sounds really far out. But when you listen to him talk about it, you start to realize, oh my God, this guy might have been able to do that. He was very dedicated to it. And it's, you know, then you listen to the Rosicrucian recordings and you realize that's a big deal for them, is this sort of self-awareness through hypnosis. I don't think they were thinking, oh, well, we should get people to run out and kill other people. But I think they were like, they were exploring this area, and he was on board for it. And so as he became more and more isolated, he sort of fell into his own mind to a large extent. And so it sort of paints a very clear path to me towards, you know, RFK.
What's interesting is when you look at RFK's children actually don't believe that Sirhan Sirhan was the sole killer, right?
Yeah.
Robert Kennedy Jr. Has visited Sirhan Sirhan in prison and said he doesn't believe it and called for a new investigation very recently.
And could that happen? Is there a chance that there could be a new investigation? Is it too late that we could ever even find out? Let's just say hypothetically that there was someone else there. You know, is it too late that we could find out who it was? Or
legally, Sirhan's exhausted all of his appeals, so I don't know exactly what the legal road for that would look like. I don't know enough about California law to know if that's possible. But for all extensive purposes, it seems to be kind of his legal opportunities seem to have come to an end.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, short of somebody stepping forward and saying I was the second gunman or I was part of this in a convincing way that matched the timeline, that matched all the evidence, that made sense, which, you know, you can triangulate all that stuff. It's all available. It would be hard to, I think, re-examine this. I mean, we're doing a yeoman's job. We've slowed it down really, really slow, and still there are gray areas that are hard to explain. And that's part of a conspiracy. You know, you need a couple ingredients, and that's a big one. That, you know, you can't assume that you're going to know everything about a person's state of mind or what happened with the bullets exactly, because bullets can do funny things. They sometimes don't go straight, you know? So we can only know up until what we don't know. And then we got to pull the camera back after we tell the whole story in the podcast and ask ourselves what we really believe.
Which I can't wait to see at the end, what you do really believe. When you, just a few more questions before we wrap up here, I want to get back to Kennedy. And I keep thinking about, you know, after Kennedy gets shot, you know, Nixon rises to power and for all intents and purposes changes America forever, more so than I think most presidents ever have, and will always be remembered as, you know, for the lists and all the nefarious things he did and being impeached and so on. And do you guys think about the alternative future that could have existed had Kennedy, you know, gone on and become president?
Yeah, of course. I mean, what you wonder if we would be where we are today, or whether the issues of race that are sort of bubbling up in our society today would not have been more dealt with in a clear and beneficial way for everyone. He was, you know, he brought people together in a big way, you know, and if we had had a president who was less divisive and a president who was more willing to look at everything, make decisions, remake decisions if he thinks it's wrong, to accept everybody as American who is American, no matter what color they are or what race they are, we might be in a very different place.
It seems that RFK was one of those rare, humble politicians, you know, grew up in essentially royalty. And by the, you know, when you see the videos of him on the campaign, you know, the audio clip that you play in the podcast when Martin Luther King is killed, where he says, you know, I understand to the African-American people in the audience that you want to feel hatred towards white people, but that's not the way forward. It seemed like he really understood in a way that I've never really heard a politician of that power, that much, you know, that much height. He understood race in America, and it really does feel like had he stayed alive, had he gone on to become president, that we may not have the issues that we do have today.
Yeah, and class. He toured the poverty-stricken areas of America. He understood class. He recognized he was privileged. He had the self-reflexive transparency that you would want in a leader. You know, ultimately, he went through the juggernaut, right? He was sitting beside Eugene McCarthy red baiting at one point. Is that not right?
It's not Eugene.
It's not Eugene.
Joe.
Sorry.
Joe McCarthy.
Oops. Can I do that
Joe
again?
McCarthy.
Take two. I'm going to retake that.
Voice?
Eugene was the Democratic runner. I got it. Yeah. Okay, so he was sitting beside Joe McCarthy in the red baiting era, and he was a very tough attorney general in some ways, but then his brother was murdered, and he saw that the country was pulling itself apart, and I think he had a moment of clarity.
But then why did we choose Nixon after all this? I mean, if the country was pulling, was it like, okay, well, this guy can pull it apart further? I mean, it's like choosing Trump today, right?
Well, yeah. It was a little complicated because, you know, after Senator Kennedy was killed, then Humphrey emerges as the nominee, who was the vice president at the time, and he didn't really unite the Democrats. I think that's something that we can understand. He was not an exciting candidate, especially when compared to somebody like Robert Kennedy. And Nixon won.
Yeah. And also I think that our fallback position as a society is towards conservative thought and conservative practices when we're in a crisis situation, you know, or at least a perceived crisis situation. You know, our society on a whole it's shifting. You know, our demographics are shifting, our economy is shifting, the way people go to work, deal with work. A lot of things are shifting, and some people are feeling left behind, some people are striving forward, and we're going through change, and there's always going to be an undertow of conservatism when change takes place. That's my personal opinion.
All right. Well, this has been truly fascinating. I cannot wait to hear the rest of this audio series. I literally snuck out of my house this morning and took a very, very long walk to continue listening. So I'm very excited to see how it all comes together. Thank you both for taking the time to chat today. This has been really fascinating. Can you tell people where they can find all this fascinating stuff and what to expect next?
Sure. The RFK Tapes is available wherever you get your podcasts.
And Mind Control.
Mind Control this next. Week. Yeah, Mind Control.
But try
mind
to start control, at the what? Beginning. You know, try to start at the there, beginning.
Is there a chance that I might be mind controlled to go do something I don't want to do but after listening to it? Or
No. I think you'll be asking questions about, you know, what the human mind is capable of.
Fascinating. Well, I really appreciate it, and I urge everyone to go and give this a listen.
Thanks so much for having us.
Before we get to the closing of this episode, I just wanted to say one last thing about Robert Kennedy. The hotel where he was assassinated has long since gone from the skylines of Los Angeles, and its place is a school and an RFK memorial bearing Kennedy's words, which read in part, "Few will have the greatness to bend history, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events. Each time a person stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustices, it sends forth a tiny ripple of hope." I thought that was pretty poignant considering where we find ourselves today. Thanks to my guests this week, Abby Tracy, Mark Smerling, and Zach Stewart Pontier. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you believe in conspiracy theories, maybe you can just take off that silver foil hat and it will be beamed into your brain. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, my editors at Vanity Fair, and thanks, of course, most of all, to my sponsors, Fleur and Mattress Firm. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you all next week.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.